you talked earlier about how you had a limiting belief before you started all of this of like making six figures. I can't believe that. And now you're like, I'm going to be a millionaire by 40. that mindset shift is incredible. But I think it speaks to the power of what you said, which is you don't have to be convinced that it'll work for it to work. Yep. You just have to do the thing. Mm-hmm. You just have to take the action, take the step, be willing to make mistakes and learn from them, and then take more steps. And then, like you said, you'll get that evidence. The universe, life will feed back to you like, oh, this works. I can just do shit and it'll work. Welcome back to Making Money, where we talk about how to make more money. Surprise, surprise. Keep more of what you make and make your money work harder for you. I am your co-host, Benjamin Foss, and sitting across from me, as always, is the wonderful entrepreneur and business owner, Paul Ng. Paul, how are you today, my friend?
I am doing very well, thank you.
It is tax day. The end of the hustle is almost here, or at least a temporary reprieve.
Temporary reprieve. Let's put it that way.
I'm really excited this week to have Seth here with us. He has a business type that we have not really talked about yet on this show, and I love like the way that you're been approaching your business. So before we get into all that, though, tell us a little bit about you, a little bit about your background, and like, have you always been kind of in the entrepreneurial space, or is that something you came to later?
Yeah, so I'm Seth. I come from a background of photo and video. I started off as a wedding photographer and then evolved into a wedding videographer. And I would say I haven't always been entrepreneurial, but it's something that I strived to do when I was younger. I just had a lot of like limiting beliefs that stopped me from doing that. And so after reading so many Tony Robbins books and a few business books, I finally made the commitment to try. And so I think I've just been trying for a very long time, and now I'm starting to see the results of those efforts. So I definitely was a late bloomer, I would say.
So before you started your own business, what were you doing?
Yeah, so we can go back to, I guess, maybe 10 years ago. Let's go 12 years ago. I was working at a hotel as a sales coordinator, and I just found a camera, meaning my friend had given me a camera, and I decided, like, I wanted to get into photography. And so I took the camera everywhere that I went with me, and so I was working full-time as a hotel salesperson and then part-time just doing shoots here and there. And it wasn't until I'd say like a year and a half later that I actually made my first check with a camera. And I was like, oh, cool. This is what it's like to make money outside of your 9-to-5 job. And so after that feeling, I just kind of started chasing that and trying to turn that $400 into more money eventually. And so that's kind of what happened.
How long ago was that?
That was in 2013, 2014. So I probably got the camera in 2013. 2014 is probably when I made my first like check. And then 2015 is when I quit my job to go work as a full-time wedding videographer.
I love that. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. So 10 years now, truly in that entrepreneurial space. And how long have you been doing your current business? So now instead of shooting the video and mm-hmm. the photos yourself, you're helping others with the editing, which is a great niche to be in because mm-hmm. it's tedious and a lot of people don't want to do it.
Yeah.
So how long have you been doing that side of things?
Oh yeah. So I started that in May of 2022.
Nice. So almost 3 years.
Yeah. Almost 3 years. And, I think it was through a book that I read called The Millionaire Fastlane by DJ DeMarco. I don't know what it was. This is not a how-to book at all. It doesn't tell you anything about how to build a business. It just gives you these overarching concepts. And for some reason, I read that book and it just clicked with me to start this editing business. So I, at some point in my own wedding photography, videography career, I started outsourcing. And so reading that book, I just had this epiphany. I'm like, oh, why don't I create a team of editors and then start outsourcing and selling that as a service, and changed my life. Honestly, it changed the way that I approach my life and business. And I'm no longer thinking in terms of what do they call it, the business owner versus the operator. Yeah, I'm not thinking from the owner standpoint anymore. It's more the, or did I mix that up? Is it the
opposite?
Yeah.
I'm not thinking from the operator standpoint. It's the owner standpoint, and it's really been beneficial for my growth.
I love that. Mm-hmm. So you kind of had this beautiful conjunction of seeing your own needs mm-hmm. in the niche you were in, and then reading. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're an avid reader, which is great, and. Yeah, sometimes you have those epiphanies, you know, and whether it's and you see a problem, you're like, oh, I have this problem. Mm-hmm. Other people have this problem. Why don't I solve this problem and get paid to do it?
Absolutely. And honestly, it was more of like it started off as like a little experiment. I won't go into the full history. Maybe we'll get into it later. But I had a lot of limiting beliefs about making money. I just could not for the life of me. Imagine making money, firstly, outside of my 9-to-5 job, and then secondly, making like six figures. I just never thought it was possible. And so
that used to be me too.
Yeah. And so creating Editing House was kind of just like a, let's just challenge these beliefs, because the best way to change your belief is to see the results. And so you see the results by taking action. So I just started taking a bunch of action, like pretending that I believed in myself. And then the results started to produce. And then I'm like, oh, cool. And so now my bar is like so much higher as to what I can achieve. So it started off with, can I make like $15,000 off this little editing business? And I blew that out the water that year from like May till November. I think it was like $35,000. And my little brain was like, oh, I did this on a laptop. Like, that's kind of crazy. And then from there, it's been like, how can I keep increasing that number and therefore also increasing the belief that I have to do more and more? So, yeah, that's been my little journey.
Well, tell us a little bit about your education and training in this editing.
Mm, absolutely. So that came as a result of just being in the industry. So if you want to go as far back to photography, I never really had formal training. I just kind of picked it up through having an eye for it, but also having a few friends that trained me. And then the editing portion of it, it just kind of comes as you embrace or you embark on the journey of being a photographer, videographer. I'm not saying I'm the best, but I definitely think that I have an eye for what looks good. So not every videographer or photographer is going to have, you know, the eye. You know, the stuff that I did when I first started out, I thought was amazing, but like, now I'm like, oh no, that's trash. So I think there is this like element of having, I don't know, just an eye for things that look good. And so, yeah, I'd say partial experience and then partially having this like little, eye for things.
That's great. How about the, clientele? Where and how do you get your clientele?
Yeah, totally. So initially, I started reading books on cold emailing. And so I really wanted to focus on that because being in the industry, I know what works and what doesn't work, or I at least knew what would work on me. And so I worked with some people to help me put together an active campaign email automation, and we personalized it as best that we could. And so, you know, initially I had a list built of like 2,500 videographers or photographers all over the United States. And so we would just blast out these emails every day. And then that really was the first push into the first like $35,000 for the business. And then at this point, getting clients is definitely more like word of mouth and then just hyper personalized emails. So I don't use any email manager. I forget the name of the softwares, but I don't use anything else except a person that types an email and has very specific things to say about that videographer's work. So we will go to, let's say, Paul's video website. We'll look at a video. We'll find something to comment on the video and we'll say, hey, Paul, really liked what you did in this video. Here's what we do. And so it's a slower burn, but it's more hyper personalized. And I think people respond to that a lot better. So just being personable, honestly, trying to not sound like every other email that you get that says, hey, so-and-so, or they don't even use your name most of the time. It's just like, here are our services as a subject. Do you want to give us some money? So we've done everything we can to kind of avoid the typical spammy outreach.
Yeah, you're trading volume for personalization mm-hmm. in the hopes of higher conversion.
Yeah.
And actually getting them to open the email and actually read it and reach out, which I think is great. Mm-hmm. It's a great strategy, especially because Like, you don't need a million clients, right? No. You don't. And like, oh, well, actually, are you working, are you emailing people all over the country? Or are you sticking with Denver? Or like, how does that, does being local matter to you at all?
No. And that's kind of what the book Millionaire Fastlane kind of did for me, was like, you want something that scales. So we can be anywhere. I mean, we have clients that are literally in Australia or somewhere else overseas. And then we have some that are in Maryland, Colorado, DC. So they're all over. But to your point, it's nice to not scale too fast. I mean, I'm sure we've all heard that, because right now, if I were to keep doing those automations, my company might break, because if people are actually interested at that level, we only have a few like really solid editors. So I'm already pretty cautious with who I hire. Like, everyone that I hire, it's, I have very few editors relative to how many clients we have, but they're all very good. And so it takes time to do that. So right now, if I flip the lever and get more clients, like, we're not going to be able to service them all until I kind of find more good editors, I guess.
I think that is a good like self-awareness of your part, recognizing like, here's the systems of my business, here's what we can handle, here's the constraints. So like, for you, you're recognized, like, I can go out and get new clients tomorrow.
Yeah.
That's not the constraint of my business. It's not the demand, it's the supply of like the quality editors. And then like, I think it's also good because you're maintaining a certain level of integrity in the quality of what you're offering. You're like, I'm not going to sacrifice quality for speed in this. And I think, you know, over time, that's going to help create that reputation. I mean, you're already seeing that, right? Because you're getting the word of mouth and those clients. But also, I mean, it's going to let you charge more, I think, than a lot of other people that are just it's speed, 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 and they're going to make mistakes and whatever. Then people learn the hard way that you get what you pay for, right?
Absolutely.
Where you can step in and be like, hey, we're not the cheapest, but we're one of the best. Yeah. And like, that's a good place to be.
And that is one of our selling points. When I have a one-on-one call with someone, I'm saying, hey, look, we're only going to assign one editor to one person. So we're not going to shift around. You know, we want to keep everything consistent. And this reminds me, have either of you seen an old documentary, like in the last 7 years, Hero Dreams of Sushi on Netflix?
No.
Okay. Long story short, it's about this sushi restaurant. It's like in a subway in Japan, and it is like a 5-star Michelin restaurant. Basically, it's like one of the best sushi restaurants in the world. And this guy that runs it, the quality is from it. The quality matters at every point. And so one of his philosophies was that, you know, I've got a tuna guy, right? I ask him to give me 10 tuna, and of that 10, only one of them can be the best. So I pick one and I discard the rest. Same for my shrimp, my salmon. And so I've kind of taken that philosophy and kind of had the same for my business, where it's like, I'd rather be really, really good at what we do and do it on a smaller scale and scale slowly than to just take all the business we can get and do it poorly.
I think the ability to be able to do that is a good technique as well. Most people don't do that. You know, they get into a business and it's about volume first, because I need to make as much as I can because I might be starving tomorrow. I think the way that you've approached it is very commendable. But actually, what's really interesting is the number of people that we've talked to have listened to at least one of the seminars of Tony Robbins, if not gone through a course with Tony Robbins. I think like-mindedness in what we are promoting here, as well as the people that actually have come onto our podcast, have so much like-mindedness before we even know it. This podcast really is about our guest. It's not about Ben and I trying to talk about us, honestly. Yeah. It's really about letting our listeners get a feel for entrepreneurship or venturing into, dabbling into, whatever word you want to use, to get into the whole world of, I don't want to be in the 9-to-5 anymore, because 9-to-5 is so mundane for some. And of course, for a lot of people, it's the stability of a regular paycheck with benefits and vacation or whatever you want to call it. But coming from this side over here, it's a lot different. We don't think about, okay, there's a steady paycheck that looks the same or close to it every 2 weeks or whatever you're paid. But it's really, where can I take it? Where can you take it? Exactly. So we'd love to hear.
Yeah, this is super infantile stages. However, I have been working with some developers now. So my rule for myself is, if the idea comes to me and I can't do anything but think about that idea and focus on executing, then it's like a pretty good idea. And so I'm at that phase where it took no effort to, the decision was easy. I'm like, yes, I'm doing this and I'm going to do everything that I can. So AI is a big thing right now. And so I have been pondering for the last like 4 months, like how do you get into building an AI business without having the experience to do it? And so thankfully I've been able to use kind of some of the blueprint from building Editing House to then help me build this new idea. So without getting into the nitty gritty, basically I'm building a software that's going to be helpful for videographers and photographers. It is actually one of the aspects of AI that has not been, or the business that has not been tapped already with AI. And so I'm like really excited about it. I'm literally piecing it together. And I think that's exactly how I did Editing House. I didn't have a blueprint. I didn't have anyone tell me what to do. And I think that's kind of the fun of it. But I have this idea. And so I've got on the phone with some friends who are like super versed on building software. And then I just hit the floor running. So I'm in the early stages of building an AI software for wedding photographers and videographers alike that I think is going to be like my million-dollar idea. You know, I told myself I wanted to be a millionaire by 40, and I think that this could help. I'm not going to say it's going to be the idea. But yeah, it's just kind of fun to be back in that place of like being super excited about something and curious about, oh, how does this work? And you're learning. And so, I mean, even today I had plans for work for Editing House, but I spent like 6 hours on calls with developers, just asking questions, talking to them about my idea, like what's possible, what's not. And I think that's kind of like how anyone that's not into entrepreneurship should take it. Like, there is no blueprint. There's no right or wrong way to do it. It's just you do it, you try. If it works, great. If it doesn't, figure out another way to make it work. And I think that's kind of how I even got to this point that I'm at now, just by experimenting.
I want to highlight something because you talked earlier about how you had a limiting belief before you started all of this of like making six figures. Can't believe that. And now you're like, I'm going to be a millionaire by 40. that mindset shift is incredible. But oh, I think it speaks to the power of what you said, which is you don't have to be convinced that it'll work for it to work. Yep. You just have to do the thing. Mm-hmm. You just have to take the action, take the step, be willing to make mistakes and learn from them, and then take more steps. And then, like you said, you'll get that evidence. The universe, life will feed back to you like, oh, this works. I can just do shit and it'll work. And now, I mean, went from six figures feeling impossible to a millionaire feeling like an inevitability. That's an incredible mindset shift. But you've done that by just taking the steps and following through.
Yeah, absolutely. Don't hold me to that million by 40, by the way. If it's not 40, it's going to be sometime. No, I forget who said it, but it takes like 51% belief in yourself to do something. So when you've finally gone past the doubt and you just have that 1% extra belief, boom, like you're moving. And I think that for anything in life, including business, like belief is everything. And we could get into law of attraction. I mean, I've spent more time than I would like to admit on that in my younger years and seen it now in my later years. But yeah, it really just comes down to what you believe about yourself. And it's like, I like to simplify it sometimes. Like, most people won't do anything they don't believe they can do. And so that's why you see a lot of people not trying anything. But if they just knew like it's possible, it would change their lives. Like, they would just take that first step and maybe not get the results right away, but they'd have the confidence to take the next step and the next. And then next thing you know, you've built something or you've done something or accomplished something in your life that you didn't think was doable ordinarily.
Man, once you start getting momentum, I mean, it builds and it builds. And I think one of the biggest mistakes a lot of like what we call the wantrepreneurs make is feeling like they have to have 10 steps planned out before taking the first. Mm-hmm. And like, no, just take the first. You know, because sometimes you don't even know what the second step should look like until you've taken the first step. And you get that information as you go. And that's kind of what you're talking about. Like, you figure it out as you go. And being willing to just take that first step is such an underrated part of being an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I just get scrappy. Like, I'm just scrappy. And it might not work. I had a recent conversation with someone. And I guess it didn't dawn on me that I guess most people don't see all the failed businesses. They only see like Editing House and my photography and then the real estate stuff that I got into. But like, there were so many failed attempts, and there's something there, you know, it's like, you're not going to hit every single time. But those failed attempts are kind of meaningful in their own way, I would say.
You know who has, I believe, the most missed shots in NBA history?
I know the answer.
It's Michael Jordan.
When such a big name.
Yeah,
he's the GOAT. I mean, well, there's a debate between him and LeBron. Yeah. I think he's the GOAT. But regardless, you look at someone who's like the greatest of all time, and you don't think he leads the league in missed shots, but he does. And it's kind of like speaking to what you're talking to. It's like, you know, you see these great achievers. You see the Tom Brady's, the Michael Jordan's, the LeBron James of the world. You don't see the hours and hours of grinding, the missed shots, the losses. Tom Brady won a bunch of Super Bowls. He lost some Super Bowls too, right? And or missed the playoffs. I mean, in one point in his career, he went 10 years between Super Bowls, right? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times we forget about all those failures or all those missed shots, those missed attempts. And then it creates this illusion in our head of like, oh, well, people, like, they're just fundamentally different from me. They just, everything they do touches, everything they touch turns to gold. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that's not how reality works. And so I would love to hear just like a brief snippet. Like, what are some of the things that you've tried that have failed?
Like three clothing brands. Well, I guess two of them failed because I gave up. So I didn't actually fail, but my belief systems kind of stopped me from like executing. And then the third time I actually got to the point to where I got money. I had people paying me for those. So those were a couple of them. A web design agency, which is something I've built a lot of websites over the years, but I just did it just because I knew someone else that did it. And I'm like, oh, let's try this out. So I definitely started that. And then when it got overwhelming, I kind of stopped. There's probably a lot more that I'm missing out on, but it's been like two decades of like wanting to do something and then not finishing it or wanting to do it and running into some obstacle. But it's okay. Like I kind of known that about myself. I used to be the person that would start something and then switch to something else all the time. But it's like, what do they say? You fail often, fail fast or something. What's the slogan? Yeah. Make all your failures now so that you don't have to like deal with them later. Like if I would have spent a decade on that one clothing business and running into the same obstacles, then I would have moved on to the next thing, which then let me move on to the next. So I'm a huge proponent of just taking the actions, not being good at it. If it works, cool. If not, let's move on to the next thing.
Yeah. Go ahead.
What are some of the things that kind of scare you or make you apprehensive?
In life or business or?
You know, kind of in both because, you know, life is our journey and the business is part of the journey, right? Mm. So kind of take
us. For some of us, the business is our life.
True that.
It's true.
True that.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think without getting too in the weeds, I let's put it this way. I had an astrologer tell me something about my future when I was 18. And basically he'd said, like, I don't see a lot of money in your future. And so that, as a young 18-year-old, cemented in my brain.
To say.
Yeah, he meant well, and I've talked to him since. But that was like honestly my biggest crux because I believed it. Like I did not question it. I was like, yeah, that makes sense. And so looking back now, all of my actions literally lined up with that belief system. It became a self-fulfilling prophecy. And the amount of time that I spent thinking about that, I mean, it was insane. And so I did a lot of work. Long story short, one of my friends, he was a genius pothead. And I saw him go from working in his room, like sleeping 14 hours and working maybe once or twice, to then getting his first ever senior software engineer job without a formal education. He taught himself all this stuff. And my first thought was, wow, that must be in his birth chart, like straight up. And so I did a lot of work to get past that. I mean, so much work. And still, there's like 10% or 5% of that. And so that's where I think the question was, what do I hesitate about? Or there's a little bit of hesitation, a little bit of fear from this like super like nonsensical astrological reading from years ago. And so on one hand, it was like, why would he tell me that? Like, why did he tell me that because it almost ruined my future. But then at the same time, I'm like, well, if he didn't tell me that, I wouldn't have taken all the steps that I took to work on the belief system and to get over that. So it does exist. It's like pretty dormant and sometimes it comes back. But then I remind myself of like, okay, here are the accomplishments, here are the things that you've done. And then it works to help me break past those like little barriers. And I won't get too deep in it, but that's where Tony Robbins came in. So I actually didn't follow him beyond the entrepreneurial stuff, but like the whole beliefs and I mean, his Awaken the Giant Within book really was the catalyst. I mean, that was what changed my trajectory. It was a starting point. And yeah, I'd lie if I said I didn't have a little bit of that fear and that doubt still in the background, but it's kind of the same
thing. We all do.
Yeah.
You know, and courage is not the absence of fear. It's the willing to act in spite of it. And like, that's what I think you're showing in all of this. It's courage. Mm-hmm. It's not that you don't have fear. It's that you don't let it stop you.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that. So now that you've been doing this business for almost 3 years, mm-hmm. you've got a number of basically subcontractors mm-hmm. that are working on editing for you. What are some of your goals with mm-hmm. this business? What are some of the next steps? Like, where do you go from here?
Yeah. I would like to replace myself eventually. So my day-to-day is mostly project management, just kind of overseeing quality control and setting up automations to make my life a little easier. So I would like to at some point be able to remove myself. And I wrote on my board at one point, I want to sell the business. Don't know if that's going to happen, but I think it'd be nice just to say that I sold a business. I don't think it'll be like a $1 million exit. Therefore, I guess putting
it very easily could be.
It could be.
To be honest, because I mean, you get once, especially if you get to $1 million in revenue, you can get to, I mean, depending on the industry and the buyer and the next day, but you can get to a 4 or 5 multiplier. Now you're looking at a $4 or $5 million exit potentially. I mean, you know, I'm not an expert in business acquisition, but I mean, I do look into this stuff because it's a common theme among many entrepreneurs and myself included is wanting to build something that becomes a sellable asset, not just a high paying job.
Right.
Which is what a lot of us are, like we're solopreneurs or that's what I am right now with my appraisal business. I basically have a high paying job,
right?
You know, in a lot of ways. And so I love that goal for you. And I wouldn't sell yourself short of like, oh, this won't be the thing that it very well could be the thing that makes you a millionaire even before the software, whatever. And maybe this is what gives you the funding for the software ideas, right? Because development costs can be pretty high. You know, like code doesn't write itself, although AI's trying. I would say like, don't sell yourself short, man. Like there's so much demand. The wedding industry is growing. People are spending more money than ever on weddings. And you've got something that's global. If you can create a system where you're consistently creating a high quality product and it can run itself without you, there will be someone who wants to buy that business. Once you get to probably $1 million in revenue usually is like the baseline if you want like a good multiple. Right. Anything lower than that is just too small for most like PE firms to really care about.
Yeah. I think about this often. And I agree I'm selling myself short. And I also agree that I'm like, it's like taking the one step before you jump type thing. Like I would actually be thrilled if someone bought my business for $100,000. Like even not 50, but $100,000. I'd be so happy because all it would do is help me know that I can sell a business. Then I have the confidence to then work up to those higher numbers. But yeah, you're right. I think I'm kind of selling myself short and I need to kind of broaden my horizons a little bit. But we're getting there. You know, it's a slow.
Yeah, you're getting
working
there.
Up
no,
to the beliefs.
Great.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're looking at, so for scaling, for next steps, what would you say is sort of the fundamental constraints? Like what's keeping you from growing right now? Or what problems do you need to solve?
Yeah, I think I am too precious with the business in a way so that I feel like I'm too attached to the outcome of things. Being a photographer, a videographer, and having a super high standard of quality kind of does inhibit me a little bit because I know how difficult it is to edit well. And I know that there are very few people that are willing to offer those services at a price that would help me also benefit financially. So at this point, I am trying to find a way to hire more editors of good quality. I'm starting to get more luxury clients who are willing to pay more. And so that means that I might be able to have a little bit more money to then pay to an editor. But a lot of the scalability right now is super my own limitations. Like, I'm just like, I don't know. I don't think there are that many good editors out there. And so I'm not really putting forth the effort. But as we were talking before, doubling down on the existing clients has been a really big game changer. So it's like I can scale from within, I guess, without having to scale outwardly. So we started off as just a photo editing agency, but once AI started hitting the market, a lot of photographers started going there. And so I pulled the lever and said, let's just offer video. And so we have a good amount of clients who do both. And there is an influx of wedding photographers who are also realizing that they can scale their efforts and their finances if they just offer both. And so we've got this like super good sweet spot where we've got photographers who know nothing about video, but they have all the gear. Like, they have the camera, they've got a husband or a boyfriend or someone else to shoot the video. And then those are the best clients because they're not picky at all. Like, they just want to see the video look good. So we're tapping into that, again, tapping into our existing client base who offer both photo and video. And that's really helped us see like an 80% year over year for this year specifically. And that's kind of what I want to focus on, is just client nurturing and then slowly start adding more video editors and photo editors and stuff like that.
Now, are you able to charge more for the video side?
Yeah, I am.
Or so how is the pricing structure for something like that work? Is it hourly? Is it by the size of the project?
That's a good question. So I structured it in a way where it can cater to both sides. So the photographer who's just getting into videography, they actually only need our base package, which is a $385 package. It just gives you a 5-minute highlight video, nothing else. But the more seasoned videographers, people like me, we would add, we have add-ons. So it's kind of like an a la carte thing. So if you want to add on color grading, if you want to add on narration, like adding the vows to the video, multicam edits, those packages go up to like $985 and probably beyond that. Honestly, we charge for additional minutes too. So 5 minutes is the base package, but a lot of people of that caliber need like 7 to 8. So on average, those videos, I mean, we've had $985 to like $1,000. And the good thing is my editors don't charge any more than they would for like a 5-minute video. So that's been the sweet spot for me anyways.
Yeah. How do you structure paying your editors?
Yeah. So photo, you know, I guess on both sides. For photo, I started by saying, here's what our budget is. Here's what we can afford to pay you. And so we just kind of put that out there and see who's willing to bite at that price. It's a pretty fair wage, all things considered, especially the volume of work that they get. Video is a little bit more challenging because, as you might know, video is not an easy thing to edit. And so people will charge way more. And so I've actually had to bend the knee to their pricing and say, what will you charge me? And so I'm absolutely willing to pay someone more who is like really, really good, if it just means less of a headache for me. And so that's kind of the model for pricing right now, is just any good video editor, I'm like all ears to their pricing up to a point. It has to be lower than the base package of $385, but I think we're anywhere from 200 to 300 basically is the average range for paying an editor for video.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And then, so I'm just trying to think, because one of the most common mistakes that a lot of entrepreneurs make is they undercharge. Because what happens is a lot of times new entrepreneurs will look at their competition, like they're charging this, so I'll just come and charge just a little bit less. And then you end up commoditizing yourself into oblivion. You know, it's a race to the bottom there.
Yeah.
And I think in a lot of ways you're doing the right thing by focusing on quality and selling yourself based on quality. But I'm thinking, so if someone orders, you know, is paying you roughly $1,000 for one of those types of packages, like how many hours worth of labor is that taking up? Like, cause I'm trying to think from like a scaling and cause the thing is, like, in order to scale, you have to have some level of like pretty good profit margins, like 30-40% at least, because you've got to have room to advertise, to invest in things that are not going to be profitable for 6 or 12 months, to bring people on that are not directly contributing to the revenue but are helping keep the wheels turning, you know, whatever the case may be. And that's one of the things that I've learned also even in my own business, mm-hmm. is like, I have to have room to invest in the business, or like, it's never going to grow. Cause it can't just be me all the time grinding 12 hours a day. Right. Yeah. Like I have limits.
Yeah, totally.
So I'm kind of curious, like, what is your, like how much wiggle room do you have in those profit margins? Like, are your editors taking like 80%, 70% of the income, or like, how does that work?
So dare I say, I think I built kind of the perfect business. So photo, it's, they take like 40%. So I take 60.
Nice.
Video, we're ranging from like 60 to 80, just depending. Oh, 80 is probably too high. 60 to 75, just depending. So,
And that's your portion?
So yeah, my portion.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a good margin.
Yeah, that's good.
Because there's no overhead. And again, I set the rates from the get-go. And so there's no overhead. There are pretty, it's pretty cheap labor, relatively speaking. So profits are pretty high on that business. And to your question, I don't know if you were starting to ask this, but as I scale, I don't think I'll need to do any more. I kind of do have like the cliche 4-hour work week, I think is the name of the book. Like,
I like that book, actually.
I have not read that book.
I thought it was a book for lazy people when I first saw the cover, and I didn't read it for years, and I kept seeing it. And I was like, okay, this book is so popular, I got to give it a shot.
Yeah.
And I ended up really liking it, actually.
I've never read it, but I know that I'm doing the 4-hour work week because like, I'll be lucky to hit 4 hours sometimes. And some of my friends kind of complain about that. But it's like, I want more to do sometimes, but then at the same time, it's like, yeah, this is sometimes all the business calls for. So you got to figure, when we send out, like we get a video, I have a 5-week lead time to get that video back. And there's not much happening on my end. Same for photo. We've got 7 to 10 business days. So they're editing. I'm kind of just like doing the back end stuff or trying to figure out ways to scale. But it's kind of like an ideal scenario. And sometimes I'm like pinching myself being like, oh, is this actually happening? Like I'm not doing much, but it's working. So that's the idea. I wanted to create the laziest business that I could possibly create and making the most money that I could possibly make. And it seems to be working for now.
You know, a lot of times those are the businesses that actually do the best.
Yeah.
Yeah, I listened to a interview recently with the founder of ButcherBox. And when he started the business, I think it was like his third business that he started.
Mm-hmm.
He literally said that he started it because his wife was having some dietary issues with like the quality of meat that they were able to find. And he's like, well, I'm just going to start this business over here, but I don't want to run it. Like, I'm just going to make it as automated as humanly possible and all this stuff. And now it's like, you know, $500 billion a year or whatever. Oh, wow. I don't forget what it is. But it's a freaking huge business. Yeah. Like, ButcherBox is huge.
Yeah.
And it's grown tremendously. But yeah, so often the best businesses are the ones that are built from the ground up to not need you.
Yeah,
absolutely. You know, and the less that it needs you, to go back to the earlier point, the easier it will be to sell someday if you decide that you want to do that. So, yeah, I agree with you. I think you've got a great model going. I mean, I'm slightly jealous of the four hour work week thing. Hey.
Yeah, I mean, it's like we all get burned out. And we want to not be burned out all of our life. And if it's possible to have some business that can fulfill that need or that desire, then so be it. And so I stumbled into this happy accident, basically, and I'm kind of just rolling with it for as long as I can.
Do you use virtual assistants or do you use local people?
Yeah, so I use a VA for basically cold email outreach.
Nice.
That was a newer development as of the last month or so, because I realized that we are kind of hitting a standstill, and so we could use some more leads, some more business. So I deployed a strategy for my VA, basically gave her my cold email outreach that I helped develop Editing House with, and so she kind of goes and has my email address, and so she'll send out emails on my behalf. It's a slower process. I was telling you off screen earlier, like it's a slower process, but people can really register like, the quality of the email. So it's like, we're using your name. Like I told you, we're using specifics about you. And yeah, I've enjoyed that portion. I still don't know how to use a VA for any other part of the business though. The quality control would be nice, but I think that's me being too like controlling over the situation. Like I know what looks good and I know what my clients specifically want. And so, yeah, I've been trying to find a way to use a VA or hire a VA to help me with the business, but it's just not not happening. Does anyone have any ideas for me?
This is funny because we just had an episode previously about virtual assistants, and I actually know nothing about this world. It's kind of still new to me, so it was a question I wanted to pose to see what our future guests, including our current guests right now, what's your opinion of a virtual assistant and how does it flow in your type of work?
My hunch is, I mean, finding a VA with video and photography experience is probably going to be pretty difficult, I'm guessing. So then I think it comes down to training.
Yeah.
And being willing to take the time and money investment, realizing like for a while, I'm going to have to pay this person while I teach them how to do the job. And then the amount of time I'm spending on this job is going to double or triple because training takes time, as you probably know.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the way to go, is that you're going to have to train. And, you know, maybe you take the existing virtual assistants you have if they have more hours that they're willing to take on. You know, if you have, because I think like many times when we look at hiring, you look at what is the easiest deficiency to solve. So if you have someone who is a hard worker, who shows up, who cares about doing a good job, that sort of thing already, that is a much harder problem to solve than training someone to have a good eye for like, this is the quality of the video that we want. Or, oh, you see this, see that, like that noise over there, like in that dark region. Yeah. That's not good. We need to clean that up. Or, oh, there, see how it's like a little too sepia here. We want a little bit more of a natural tone for this, you know, whatever the case may be. And I think, so you're not going to find someone who has checks like all the boxes more than likely. So then you have to sort the boxes into which ones are the easiest for me to check after the fact.
Right.
Or what's the easiest thing to train. That would be my like recommendation with that. And like I said, if you have someone who's like hardworking and like willing to learn or whatever, like if your VA is great, I would consider just trying to see if you can train them to take on more rather than bringing in someone brand new.
Agreed.
I like that. I have tried replacing me as the customer service person before, and I don't know if that goes too well because a lot of my business is built on my clients' interaction with me, and so that's been really hard. But I like the idea of like maybe having a quality assurance type person to check things that need to be checked, because that is kind of where I do spend the time. So I'll watch like a 10-minute video, make notes, and then upload the notes to the editor. And so that takes a little time, but you're right, it is kind of hard when that person doesn't have that background, and so that's where I feel stuck sometimes. So
I think it takes a lot of repetition, and that's part of the challenging thing. Now one question I have is, how often are you sending videos back for more than one round of corrections?
That's a funny timed question, because I just now gave unlimited revisions, again, to stay competitive and to keep the rapport good with my clients. So the reason for that I'll go into is because two revisions is like good for the, because I guess between the client and us, but then brides and grooms often have their own revisions. And so as of literally today, we just finished like the fifth round of a video for a client, which ordinarily would have stopped at two. So it's not often, but again, the higher the skill of the person, the more feedback you're going to get. And so we've had people in the earlier stages like tear apart a video like horrendously. It looked great to us, but it's just not their vision of like how things should look.
Yeah. And it's their special day too. But I was asking more like before you even send it to the client, like you said you would watch it and make notes and send it back. So how often are you doing that more than once?
Yeah, very seldom. Very seldom. And it's always something like super minimal. Like people have this let's put a film look over these parts of the video, and it just doesn't look good. Or sound effect. I'm like, we don't use sound effects, but very seldom. And I think that's, again, a testament to the editors that I have. I mean, they are better than me, and I've been doing it for 10 years. And so very little do I have to actually give any sort of revisions, which is nice. And then we'll maybe get some feedback from the clients too.
Yeah. So when the client is giving feedback, or the bride and groom or whatever, is that going to you and then you're the middleman between them and the editor essentially?
Kind of. So we use this software. It's called Frame.io. And so I can upload a video, and within the video, the client can just type the notes, and so everyone can see the notes. And so there's a little bit of like, there's no friction basically. Like the editor will see all the notes right there. I don't really even need to say anything, but I'll usually just say, hey, check the notes on this video, which is a pretty, it's like a newest, it's the newest development this year. Because before, yeah, I would like type an email. That. Yeah.
Well, because I'll just say, like, my thought process was, I was thinking, it's like, okay, you know, in some ways, the most efficient thing is to have them talk directly to the editor, or whether it's a text communication or whatever. Mm-hmm. But then, like, I was thinking, but you might actually need to translate a little bit for the fact that non-technical people don't know how to describe in a technical way, this is what I want.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much of that you're having to do, but I'm wondering if maybe some of that could also be offloaded as well.
Yeah.
You know that better than I do, like being on the ground, but because I've had to do this sometimes with different things that I've done is like, oh, no, I think what they're trying to say is this.
Yeah.
You know, they're just not saying it very well.
Yeah.
Like, is that something that you're having to do regularly or not really?
Not a ton, I would say. But it does pop up from time to time, if I'm being honest.
Yeah.
Every day, though, I'm trying to find ways to create less friction for myself. And so if that means hiring someone to come in and do that for me, or finding a better way to help my clients explain what they want, I'm always looking. It's a never ending thing. I've got a very deep relationship with ChatGPT for that reason, to say, hey, how can I like make this process better? And sometimes it's got really good ideas.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think, you know, what you're running into is like a lot of what you're now trying to replace is the stuff that you've built up over years of repetition.
Exactly. Which is not easy.
Yeah. Finding someone with that's willing to work at like a wage that you find reasonable is going to be challenging, which is where training then can come in handy.
Yeah.
But obviously that's a big time and money. And you might have to work more than 4 hours a week. God forbid.
I know. God forbid. There are some days where honestly I'll work like 8 hours, like a whole day. It happens sometimes.
Pull it all day or huh?
Yeah. Well, it's coming. Rough. Don't worry. It's coming. It's, you know, May's coming around. So we have a busy wedding season coming up, and it's like, I don't know what I'm spending my time doing. It's just delegation and feedback, but it somehow takes a whole eight hours. So
yeah. Yeah.
I think overseeing projects themselves take a lot more time than most people think. You know, sometimes people think, well, all you're doing is just making sure that they're getting the job done. How long could that really take? It really can take a whole day because there's so many roadblocks and so many issues that just kind of get in the way. And interference is the biggest problem, I think, when you don't expect it.
Exactly. No, you're right. It's just like anything. You're doing your tiles. It's like, I've watched all the YouTube videos. I can change that doorknob. I can put down a tile, and then there's literally something that you didn't account for. And then,
oh man. So I'll tell you a quick story. God. So one of the bedrooms up here was pink with a stripe of silver at the top for some ungodly reason. And so I talked my brother into helping me paint the room because I didn't want to do it myself. And then while we're at it, it's like, hey, let's change out all these like 90s yellow tinted plugs and light switches for something that's more modern and looks nice since we're painting the room anyway. Already face plates are removed, like we're halfway there. So we did that. And now none of the plugs work, not a single one of them. And I don't know what we did wrong, but I still, like, to this day, I can't turn on. If I turn on the light in that room, it trips the breaker and it knocks out the power to the other bedroom, too. And I have no idea what we did wrong. There's probably like an exposed wire touching a metal something somewhere in there. It's probably a relatively straightforward fix. But to your point, like sometimes you start doing these DIY projects and then like you're like, oh, I'm just changing a light switch. How hard could that be?
Yeah.
Apparently, I could just like ruin half the house.
I actually have the exact experience. I have a rental in Maryland, and I liked to do as much as I could on my own, like DIY. And so I've replaced so many light fixtures that I'm like, oh, I can do this light, like no problem. And so there was this one terrible chandelier. It's from the 1929 is, I think, the age of the house. And so it has this like ugly chandelier. And I changed like hundreds of lights at this point. And so I replaced it with a recessed light. Great. Turn the light on, and then everything upstairs just goes dark. And I'm like, wait, I know I did everything right. And I resisted the urge to call like my electrician friend because I'm like, I want to do this by myself. But I called him, showed him the wire. She's like, yeah, you did everything perfectly right. I don't see what you did wrong. And eventually, after like hour six, which should have been like a 1 hour job, I just caved, and I called an electrician, and he comes over, and I guess the house was so old that, like, ordinarily it might be something like red to red, white to white, and then the last two are like something else. The last two needed to be also like the same color as each other, and so I switched the wires, and my friend was like, well, that's what he went to electrician school for, was to help you out in like 5 minutes. And I'm like, yeah, I guess that's the case. So.
Yeah, I wouldn't have the courage to touch anything electrical on a 100-year-old house, because God knows what ancient technology is behind those drywall. Like,
dude, it's dangerous. I always told myself I'd never do electrical, and I think I'm comfortable with lights, but you just never know. I mean, those are tricky. They'll kill you.
I would agree. I touch nothing handy at all. I don't even change light bulbs.
Oh, no?
No, absolutely not.
I need to know why.
Oh, you don't.
It's because Paul has money to pay other people.
I don't even know about that, but I think, you know, there's time-wise, it makes zero sense for me to do those things, because I've tried many a times to do some simple things and realized that, you know, even painting a wall.
Yeah.
I don't need to tell you about that fiasco, how it should have taken like literally an hour.
Yeah.
No, this thing took me like 3 days, because I didn't realize painting had an art to it, that you couldn't just roll it, that there would be lines. And if you didn't do a primer on it, something's going to leak right through. That's not even supposed to, because it was a darker shade. And anyway, YouTube is really good, but I didn't use YouTube.
Yeah.
So yes, I'm going to say no. Handyman work and house stuff. No. No.
You know, I'm inclined to agree. I think I'm at a point where it's like, yes, there are people who specialize in things, and it is better to then just give it to them. I don't know where my line is. I think maybe changing light bulbs, I think I can do. But beyond that, I don't know. I'm kind of with you. Just give it to the pros. Yeah.
This is why we have a professional doing what you do.
Yeah.
Because I could not even profess to do a video. Or actually, I can't even use Adobe to edit something. Yeah. So let's just go all the way that you are the person I would hire.
Yeah, thank you. Much appreciated. Yeah, I'll be your guys' go-to editor.
Well, Seth, thank you so much for coming on the show and being so honest and open about your journey and the things. I love the mindset stuff that you've talked about and the way that you're approaching building the business. I mean, it just sounds like you're doing a fantastic job, and it's great to have you on. If anyone wants to solicit your services, what is the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Yeah, you can go to editinghouse, that's HAUS.com.
House.
It's Deutsch German. And or you can go to my Instagram, which is editing_house.
Excellent. Seth, well, thank you for coming on. We appreciate you coming on. And thank you all for listening. We appreciate you tuning in. Drop a comment down below. What is your business needing to go to the next level and to scale? Do you need more help? Do you need a virtual assistant? Do you need more education? Let us know in the comments, and we will see you in the next one.